Okay, so the advantage of speaking on the last day is you don't have to give much introduction to any topic. Could I have the lights down for a minute here? Yeah. But you also need to give the St. Crispin's Day speech about we lucky few should now attack France and win. So this is a reconstruction of a Drosophila embryo in the process of cellularizing. The white balls are centrosomes, orange is filamentous actin, blue is cytoplasmic myosin, and green in a moment is the nuclei. And this is here to remind us that the story I'm going to tell, which takes place in nice little mathematical hexagons, is much, much more complicated in the real embryo. The cells have a phenomenally complex structure, and our models do not yet account for that, nor do they account for how these cells will move around moments after they form. Okay, let's see, I think I have to click this to make it happen again. Okay, so green is chromatin, white is centrosomes, which are on the same antibody channel as myosin, and therefore I have replaced them with mathematical spheres, otherwise this is all real data. In a moment, the orange is filamentous actin. You're looking now from the outside of the embryo. This is a box about 28 micrometers across, so it's pretty high magnification. And that layer there of actin is the rings of actin and myosin followed by membrane that are invaginating to surround each nucleus and pinch them off to achieve cellularization that Eric Vieshaus told you about. This has almost nothing to do with my talk except as a reminder that what I'm about to say takes place in those cells moments after they form. So here what we have are a number of different species stained with Nipam Patel's hot antibody to engrailed or invected, and this is a Drosophila embryo sort of laid out, and those black stripes are stripes of engrailed protein on in each cell in a very thin stripe. The cells are the things the size of the laser dot. This is Manduca sexta, the tobacco hornworm, the flower beetle, a cricket, a locust, and some weird crustacean. And the point here is to say that this network, the segment polarity network that I'm going to spend some time talking about, operates in diverse organisms, operates in you, in mice, in zebrafish, in all kinds of diverse organisms. In arthropods, it dependably lays out these stripes that mark off coordinates within segments. And I'm putting it here to emphasize that only, so far as we know, well, in Drosophila, we know that the positions of these stripes are cued by prior expression of the pair rule genes that John Reinitz told you about. Those transiently expressed genes fade away, and this pattern remains permanently through the life of the fly. In other organisms, it is almost certain that this same network is triggered into action and is modulated as to where it puts its stripes by some other upstream conditions besides pair rule gene stripes. It's been co-opted through evolution to do here the same task, but probably with different trigger.
Is it known how the other ones do it?
Not to me. Nipam Patel has information about pair rule-like genes in some organisms that probably trigger this. But in general, I think it's not known.
This is one antibody for all species?
This is one, there's two, an antibody that Nipam Patel raised to engrailed and invected a companion gene seems to light up in virtually every complicated organism that anybody has used it on. Lewis wanted us to say what modules or networks were, and here's my version, which I would be willing to defend for maybe 30 seconds. So it's a set of genes whose products interact and as a consequence interact tightly and as a consequence of that interaction perform some functional task. And the concept we have is that this module has a life of its own and could be transplanted to a different context where different inputs might trigger the same old action. Where the outputs of this module could be different in which genes they turn on downstream. And we are going to think of this in this talk and in our studies as a dynamical system which we model with differential equations to keep track of the concentrations of gene products as they change continuously through time. And We think that the functions this module can perform correspond to various attractors in the phase space of this system, that is, stable or almost stable concentrations of all the different genes that the system can go to given appropriate initial conditions.
Why did you put Jonathan there?
Well, because I, you know, he wrote a nice book about thinking of determined states as the equal as the. It would be better if I put the attractors in quotes. Let me say it right now. I'm going to talk about attractors that these networks can go to. And we do not distinguish stable equilibria from small amplitude limit cycles around them from strange attractors that wrap around them, strange attractors of small amplitude. So, I think those are all attractors. We don't distinguish whether these what type of attractors these might be, and moreover, in the noisy versions of these networks, the system can dance around an attractor, and all those possibilities are equally good for performing the function of this network.
So I'm really confused. What about inputs? I mean, the definition given that way only makes sense for an autonomous system. For an autonomous system, no external inputs at all. So what would be the role of inputs? That would change the refractive structure.
Well,
the last part, the genetic module would be in a wonderful system.
Yeah, so initial conditions will affect which attractors it goes to, and continuing influences that aren't just initial transients, those could move the attractors.
So it would be a different module. When you have a different input, it would be a different module, according to your definition.
I think the 35 seconds are up. I don't want to defend. I mean, this was its. I made this slide at some other meeting Lewis was at when he was complaining about nobody has defined modules yet. So I guess I haven't either. So what we do is what we think of what we do is it's in silico reconstitution. We're going to start with a really simple core version of the network that we want to model and try to make it work, and if it doesn't work, add more biological detail until it does. And the questions we want to ask are, first, whether a network, as it's currently understood in the literature, actually can perform the function attributed to it. And second, we want to explore how sensitive the network's function might be to perturbations. So here is a sample network, I'll talk about two. We've successfully modeled two in some detail, and we get roughly the same results. And to telegraph the punchline, the message is going to be that when we get the right topological connections between gene products, connections like these, which says this RNA, this messenger RNA for engrailed, is translated to the protein engrailed, and that protein goes on to turn on transcription of the hedgehog gene to make the messenger RNA, ovals or messenger RNA. And that protein of hedgehog goes to the membrane where if other cells express patched, it can complex with that and so on. And I'll say some more about the topology in a minute, but I should start that sentence over, but I don't have time. So let me keep going talking about the peculiarities of this network. The circles means inhibit, so integrated inhibits cubitus interruptus, that gene there. And in the networks we have studied, protein-protein modifications are all important. Without them, we wouldn't have a network to study. So for example, this cleavage product of cubitus interruptus has the opposite effect on patch transcription as the initial translated protein has. And through pathways not shown, this protein triggers the cleavage of that protein. And these protein-protein interactions play a central and irreplaceable role in the function of this network. And I want to point that out because those kinds of interactions are not as easy to obtain by mass throughput DNA microarray technology. Okay, so these dotted lines represent links that we were uncertain about initially. you are supposed to think of this whole network as installed identically in every single cell, and these dotted lines here represent the edges of cells across which proteins can communicate. Note we have a ridiculous link in here whereby wingless protein in the membrane of this cell turns on and grailed over here. That, of course, can't occur directly, and I'll later in this talk about filling in the signal transduction pathway with a real model for some of the steps involved.
So this is between every cell?
Every cell has one of these copies, and every cell in our model, like that cell right there, will have six hexagonal faces that touch other cells across which these exchanges occur. The output
of hedgehog?
So patched, these two arrows here mean that patch and hedgehog make a complex here in this model, and that dimer is harmless. The consequence is to titrate out patched, which otherwise would cause this cleavage.
You said hexagonal faces, but all that matters is the graph. This is OEs, so we're not doing any PDEs.
We're not doing PDEs, okay. But we're, well, I'll tell in a moment how we mathematize this. So this, we are confident of all these solid lines because they're backed up by many publications. However, every one of these solid lines has some quantitative features, none of which we know. So for example, engrailed turns on hedgehog transcription. As a function of engrailed concentration, hedgehog transcription rate is expected to rise, but what this curve looks like is unknown to us, and I think unknown in general. We don't know what the maximum rate of transcription is. We can be sure that it saturates at some rate. It can't go arbitrarily fast because there's only two copies of the gene, and POL2 only moves so fast. It starts low. There will be some concentration of engrailed at which you reach the half max transcription rate, and at that point the curve will have some slope. Those are parameters we choose to quantify this curve. We think of them as dials, and by changing this location, by changing this threshold, by changing this slope, we can sculpt this curve into virtually any monotone curve that saturates on the screen. So we could make this curve go, you know, we could make it go like that, or we could make it go like this, or any way we want by changing these parameters, but we don't know the parameters at all. Every factor has a half-life, it decays. We don't know how fast that might be. There are exchange rates from the cytoplasmic compartment to the membrane and back again, and to other faces of the membrane, and so on and so on. And when we think of all the things we don't know, we could have measured them by getting values for 48 parameters in this quite simple network. So, in order to simulate what this does by solving the differential equations that keep track of the concentrations through time, we have to know numerical values for all of those parameters, and we don't know any of the values. So here's what we do mathematically. We write these equations. These keep track of the concentrations of messenger RNA for every gene product, and the proteins for each of those, and the concentration of dimers when appropriate. And we write a differential equation for each of those concentrations. We install a copy of those concentrations in each of many hexagonal cells. And for membrane-bound components, we keep track face by face of what the concentration is on the various membrane faces. So wingless protein can jump out of the cytoplasmic compartment to that face, move to that face, move to that face, jump off and move across to other faces, and that in a way mimics the story we heard earlier in the week about wingless sticking to these proteoglycans. We have parameters that would characterize the affinity for those binding sites, and we don't have strict molecular diffusion. We have jumping from one compartment to another, including jumping across cells. So if you're a physicist, you could make up these equations. If you're a biologist, you don't want to see them. So I just made a kind of a impressionistic painting of them.
So you don't have diffusion?
Well, we have diffusion in the sense that molecule, wingless definitely gets transported cell to cell to cell and can go a certain distance, but we're not using the standard diffusion operator because it certainly moves. And I mean, one reason is that there's almost no extracellular space for diffusion to occur in, and we suspect most moving factors stick most of their time to some extracellular matrix or something outside the cells. So if we knew parameter values, we could solve this system, which consists of, in the model I'm talking about 100 and some equations, 130 equations for four cells. We could solve it in a couple of seconds on a desktop computer.
Gary, will you be discussing how you chose the functional formula?
Not very much. That is, I don't want to discuss the algebraic recipe for this curve, because I don't think it matters at all. But the fact that it saturates like this is quite important. Different recipes, I think, will give almost identical results.
But that curve only has a single regulator as an input.
Yes, yes. So thanks for reminding me of this. What about, let's say, patched here, which has an inhibitor and an activator? There are qualitatively different ways to combine those. So one way is the way John Reinitz has done it. You basically, the consequence is that if you have a great deal of this inhibitor, you could overwhelm that with even more activator. Or you could have a model in which a sufficient amount of inhibitor would shut down transcription here regardless of how much activator there is. And that's the style that we use, by multiplying together curves of the form that I showed you. In other words, for this factor here, we would have the activators operating by a curve like this, and the inhibitor multiplying that curve by another curve that falls off like that. Okay? We have tested whether it makes any difference which kind of formula you use, and indeed it does in our hands in this network only for wingless transcription. And there you have to have this scheme whereby this inhibitor can shut down wingless regardless of how much activator there is. But for the other enhancers, it doesn't matter in our hands for this network. Okay, so we have these differential equations, and I want to spend a moment saying what's the difference between this model and others you've heard about at this meeting. No, and that's a thing that we may do and may be important. So we do not account for the fact that it takes a while after some promoter protein shows up for the first mRNA to roll off the assembly line. We do not account for that. And in case I forget to tell you about this, when we take the model I'm describing and get rid of the RNAs, so we just imagine that the gene is produces the protein directly without the intermediate RNA, then the behavior of this network changes. The robustness falls very sharply. Now, the production of an RNA from which you translate protein is a kind of delay. And reasoning from the fact that when we eliminate that delay, the behavior changes, I forecast that when we add even more delay of the kind you're suggesting, that we'll get different behavior yet. But we haven't done that. Okay, so we keep track of RNA and protein. We let both vary continuously with time using differential equations, which say, in words, the time rate of change of all the concentrations is a function exactly of the concentrations at the moment. So this is this Newtonian view of the world in which the system changes in response to the current state of the system. We do not use Boolean logic gates to represent enhancers because, even though that leads to a great simplicity and reduction of computer time spent, I think that stylization or extreme simplification is something you should prove instead of assume. So we don't use... So Eric Davidson's models assume that this curve back here, wherever it was, this curve would go like this. If this gene here is off, whatever that means, There's no transcription until it's on. When it crosses the threshold, then it jumps up. It discretely jumps to a fixed level, and there's just two levels of it's on or off. Now, we could sculpt this curve, so it is essentially that situation, but that would involve cooperativity of an enormous amount, and we think that it's better to explore whether, with what we call realistic dynamics, these networks can behave as if they were Boolean, rather than to just assume from the beginning that they must be Boolean.
The Boolean would be a simplification.
Would be a vast simplification. Is simply on or off, and then that can be fancied up by having several levels, like on, sort of on, fully on, and but it nevertheless has this discontinuous feature. Time usually moves abruptly in steps rather than continuously, and the problem with that view of the world is that the dynamics through time of the behavior of such a network can be utterly different than the differential equation model of exactly the same network. And therefore, you're in danger of inducing artifacts by using discrete logic instead of continuous concentrations.
Sorry, I mean, from a philosophical point of view, one could argue that you've made a number of arbitrary choices in the form of the nonlinearity and the fact that you're using ODE instead of PDEs, so people could make the same criticism.
Sure. So. I mean, every model is some compromise where you achieve simplicity at the cost of realism, and we have made certain compromises. So we're assuming that we have enough molecules per cell that continuous time is a good caricature. There's a hierarchy of more and more realistic models that cause more and more computer time to simulate, and we are somewhere in the middle there. We could use, as you say, partial differential equations. We don't think it's appropriate, though, because these cells are quantized. Partial differential equations would be appropriate to measure, to model the flux of some signal transduction protein through the Golgi, say. But we think, actually, ordinary differential equations are appropriate to keep track of concentrations in cells. They're discretized cells. All right.
Two questions. There were 48 parameters, but now if you have all those many compartments, presumably there are many more parameters.
No. There's just the 48 parameters. Every cell has an identical copy of this network. And the parameters that measure the flux rate of wingless protein from the cytoplasmic compartment to the membrane phase is the same in every cell for every face of every cell.
But I thought somewhere on the slide it said that you say there's seven compartments in each cell,
right.
And therefore each species has
yes.
Is broken down into seven species within every cell.
Yes. But those are not parameters. The rate at which wingless protein jumps from the cytoplasm to the membrane is the same for every membrane phase for every cell. One parameter is enough to keep track of those rates of change in every cell for every one of its phases.
For each species, one has to describe coupling between different compartments.
Yes.
So there are at least seven parameters for each species.
No, because six of the cell faces are identical clones of each other. So they all one parameter that tells the flux between the cytoplasmic compartment and that face does it for all the faces at once.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had something for ER and...
No. So our system has...
What's the similarity in the system? Is it spatially homogeneous?
It's spatially homogeneous, and it's worse than that, it's toroidal. That is, we put a ribbon of cells down and then wrap this cell around to become that cell.
But homogeneous.
Yes, it is. It's homogeneous except for initial conditions. Okay, so let's see what else. We do not try to compute or tinker with the topology of the network. Our software can't do that. We instead distill this circuitry from publications, all of them that we can find, and and just impose those on this problem and adjust only the parameters that I talked about. I've already mentioned that post-translational protein modifications are crucial, and we don't see any way to figure those out using computers. They have to come from experiments. So here's what we do with this model. We install it in every cell. We know what the wild-type pattern of gene expression should be in a real fly embryo. This represents a row of cells posterior to anterior, and every fourth cell turns on engrailed, and the cells right in front of that turn on wingless, and these are the expression patterns of some of the other gene products in this network.
So how many species do we have coupled between the cells?
We have...
If you were writing... diffusion equation, that might be a discrete diffusion equation.
Yeah.
So how many of those there are?
How many that move? Or?
Yeah. Moving species.
Well, there's hedgehog and wingless. There's just two that move in this. Yes?
When you say that you do not change the topology of the network, why are you confident that you've got everything in place?
We're not confident, but we are confident that we should not make these things up ad hoc, that we should only take them from reported experiments that we trust. And the network I showed is ridiculously oversimplified because we intentionally left out many genes, like the genes in the signal transduction pathway from wingless to engrailed. So we are going to tinker with the topology by adding in that more biological realism. The point I want to make is our computer program is not free to adjust the topology of the network.
If you would miss some crucial link, then basically this is not
going to be. You bet, and I'll give you an example in 10 seconds. So here's a dramatic demonstration of that is coming up. So
this is what you start
with. No, this is what the wild-type embryo achieves when the pattern stabilizes.
Yeah.
And we want to impose a very simple challenge to this network, which is, does it have this as an attractor in the phase space? And we test that by imposing the pattern of engrailed and wingless that we want to end up with as initial conditions. And these are all basically off. And then we ask, can this network lock in this pattern as an attractor within 200 minutes? And can it hold that pattern for 1,000 minutes, which is long enough for us? And if so, we say that the set of parameters that we used in this simulation I just described is a good set of parameters. It causes the network to do what it actually does in the fruit fly. Now, this is cheating by giving the final answer as the starting conditions, but we have explored what happens when you fuzz this out greatly, and we get essentially the same results.
So one thing I don't understand about timing, is that supposed to mimic... Are you talking about Drosophila time or computer time?
Oh, no, we're talking about the Drosophila time,
right, okay.
And that takes us a couple of seconds, so we can do this millions of times.
Okay,
so that's our test. And what we want to know, since we don't know from measurements any of the parameters, we would like to know, is there any set of parameters that causes this network to do this job? That's the first thing we wanted to know. And if so, are there a lot of such sets? How are they distributed in parameter space? So what we did is we wrote software to do this, and we ran it for months and months and months and kept getting this pattern, which is not right. And these are the best results we could achieve for the first 3 or 4 months of running this program. Now, I'm admitting something very embarrassing. We had left out these purple links when we were getting these repeated failures. So never could we get the right answer. In retrospect, it's impossible to get to the right answer no matter what the parameters are, because in this diagram, the only input to engrailed is wingless. So if wingless is on in this cell, engrailed must be on in the neighboring cells. So, you should think about things before turning, we should think about things before turning to computers. But what this illustrates is that most of the experimental literature missed this point as well. So we went back and looked harder in the literature, and we found hints that there ought to be this step here. The evidence is very weak, and we still don't trust it. There is strong evidence now for autoregulation of wingless through a sloppy paired helper gene. When we put in these links and did the same test, we started finding solutions. So let me take a moment to say how we do this test. We don't know the parameter values, but we can use common sense. We know the half-life, for example, of a protein or an RNA couldn't possibly be shorter than a couple of seconds. And if it's longer than, you know, an hour or two, it's so long it might as well be infinite in a process that's supposed to go to completion in 200 minutes. So we feel confident in assuming that these half-lives ought to lie between, you know, 30 seconds and a couple of hours. And likewise, we went through every parameter to figure out liberal maximum bounds that would be the range of biological realism. And for most of parameters, those bounds we made about 1,000-fold. In other words, the biggest allowed value was 1,000 times bigger than the smallest allowed value. So a huge range, not 1,000%, you know, 1,000, a factor of 1,000. And in order to do this in an unbiased way, we just picked points in parameter space at random. So if this room is parameter space, we pick a point here, pick a point there, and test with that test I mentioned whether it works. And as soon as we put in those missing links, it started to work at a phenomenal rate. Okay, so it started to be work so that 1 out of 200 random picks in this 50-dimensional parameter space gave a set of parameters that worked.
You need both those extra links. Do you try it with one or the other or both?
We haven't tried it separately. And we may not need the, we certainly, see, the reason is we absolutely need the engrailed inhibition link, and that's the one for which the evidence is flaky.
Right.
And the evidence is just that, the evidence is flaky, and we don't want to bet anything on that. We haven't tried them separately. So this is a picture of a parameter set in a high dimensional space. Each spoke is the axis for one parameter, and this point here means that parameter, whatever its name is, has this relatively high value. The outer circle represents the maximum limit. The inner circle represents the minimum limit. For each parameter, it's about 1,000-fold difference from here to there. And one of these polygons, like this one, traces out a parameter set. There's a one-to-one map between positive parameters and these cams on this diagram. And
the proper pattern.
All of these sets make the network do the right thing, make the proper pattern.
Okay.
I worked for a long time trying to rearrange the order so as to group these into major themes and failed.
So this is really like a random.
What it means is there's no simple, you know, cross correlations where one, if one parameter is high, the other is low. So the point of showing you the picture is that the, you know, you can imagine this being a point in parameter space that's far from this other point in parameter space, and so on. So it dramatizes how far apart these solutions, these good parameter sets, are in parameter space. And this is what the set of all the parameters we found in the first paper we published about this look like on this wheel plot. By the way, some of the axes are log axes. So, as I said, the hit rate is 1 in 200. And the point of this diagram is to show that for only a very few parameters, this one representing the effectiveness as this cleavage product of cubitus interruptus in shutting off engrailed transcription, only for some of them are little ranges ruled out. For almost all parameters, almost anything goes. Yes?
Have you already removed all of the low green organizations to get these 48 parameters and you retain the maximum of one and the K maximum input to the next one, then you get the same result? If you change the maximum expression of one gene and it has only one output, and if you change the K value required for it to induce the half max for the next gene,
yes,
that will give you the same, precisely the same result. So you remove all those lines, all those.
I don't think I understand the question we hear. Sorry?
It's equivalent to saying having non-dimensionalized.
Yes, yes, all these equations are put in dimensionless form.
So on the 48 will be independent.
Yes, yes.
But all of this is done by solving the initial value problem.
Yes, but by...
Is there a reason why not to look just... Since ultimately you're interested in a stable steady
yeah,
state,
yeah.
Can you just look for steady states? Set all time
the steady, steady states...
And then you end up with just two... Well,
no, No, the steady state, finding the equilibria is a very hard problem in nonlinear algebra with about 130 equations to solve. And there are very, very many steady states. And which one you go to depends on where you start. We had not tried that, although we have a tricky numerical way to find all nearby steady states. We haven't approached it that way.
But one way to find the steady states in numerical analysis.
It's just integrate differential equations. Yes.
But sorry, I have a sort of more basic question. You're doing some sort of a uniform sampling in parameter space. But one would think that maybe something that is biased logarithmic, you know, some logarithmic thing would. Have you tried?
So I said that these axes, some of them are log, some of them are linear, and we first made that log linear choice and then sampled randomly on that scaling of parameters. So I want to try to get across what it means to have a measure of point, you know, of a half percent.
What's the definition of hit rate?
We pick parameter sets at random, and we see if they work, if they pass that test, and one choice out of 200 works. That's what the hit rate is.
The plot is for all parameters that work.
That means one out of 200 choices of a point in 50-dimensional space works.
But the plots here show that this collection of parameters that work.
Yes, this is the set of 1,192 parameter sets that worked. And the point is they pretty much fill up the parameters. We just color-coded. We have an objective function we're trying to minimize, and I color-coded the lines as to indicate whether it was a great fit, a good performance.
Either blue or pink means pretty good.
Yes. So you can forget about the colors. If I don't use colors, this is just a solid filled-in thing. So. For example, for the slopes of the curves at the midpoint, we chose linear. Yes. Okay. So I want to underline how astonishing it is that one out of 200 points work. The measure of the set of parameter of the points that work in parameter space is 0.05. So that doesn't seem like much in a three-dimensional space. But in a 50-dimensional space, this is the way you think about this. It means that walking along axes where you have a thousand-fold variation, you have a 90% chance of picking a good value for each parameter along each axis because 0.9 to the 50th is 1 in 200. The way you visualize this is to think of the red box as the box we used, allowing a thousand-fold variation. The green box goes 90% of the way, and the interior of the green box would have a measure of, in this diagram, of 0.9 raised to the 3 power, be that much. Now, you're just supposed to imagine that diagram into 50-dimensional space to see what an enormous box you have in this big space of points that work. Okay, so parameter values all over the place in those wheel plots means this curve is all over the place in this diagram. And all the other curves are too. Now, the fact that these functional forms and strengths could vary all over the place doesn't mean that they do. The next point I want to make in this talk is, nevertheless, we think that the concept of a parameter having a particular value in some species, like fruit flies or humans, is an oxymoron. And that's because of a study done by Rockman and Ray, a recent study, in which they surveyed in medical literature reports of up and down regulation of circulating levels of proteins in human subjects that were confirmed by moving the genes involved into tissue culture cells. And I'm running out of time here, so I just gotta quickly say that they extrapolate what they found to the prediction that 43% of human genes have polymorphisms in the walking around population that lead to 2-fold to 25-fold up and down regulation of expression levels of these genes in 43% of genes, and the average up or down regulation is about 5-fold. Up and down are equally prevalent. So let's think of what that means for the network I'm talking about. suppose you had two alleles at each of 50 loci, 50 loci being the number of parameters that we have, then you can make three different possible different values of each parameter in the network, the two homozygotes and the heterozygote. And that means if you bred randomly people carrying such polymorphisms, you could make 3 to the 50th quantitatively different versions of this network. And that's more than a mole of versions. And that means very few of those versions have been tried. And that means for each of the important networks in you, it is built from parts that never worked before together. And good luck to you all. Every one of your networks is sort of on a shakedown cruise to see if it works. Okay. I think to save time, I won't do this. It's the circuit of the first patented transistor radio, which I happen to own one of in high school to listen to rock and roll music. And this has 50 parameters.
If I remember correctly, this Rockman paper, I mean, they looked at genes which were somehow, there was a problem.
They were associated with diseases, that's correct.
So somehow, I mean, do you think there's really right to immediately transfer that to the
It's the best information I have. It's not really right because, they have a bias in looking at people who are already sick. I trust the way they extrapolated this data from the studied population to the larger population. I mean, the problem is the medical doctors have enough money to go around and do these studies, and they can't just do it for people who aren't sick. So that's the database there is, and I don't know how to do better. It may not be 43%, but if it's only 20%, we still have a serious polymorphism. Well, so the idea, Lewis, is that suppose you got to build these radios, but they didn't tell you the parameters. They didn't tell you how much capacitance to put there. And you just built this, by picking pieces from barrels that had a thousandfold variation. What do you think the chance is that this radio would work in any useful way? It's about zero. Human technology.
I built them choosing the right parameters.
Yeah, me too. They just turn into smoke.
The internet, you just connect things up, blah, blah, blah. And it has the right feedback architecture.
Yes.
So it works.
Yes.
Whether you have two computers.
Yes.
Or 2 billion. So you have 6 orders of magnitude.
Yes. You're right. I mean, not all human design technology has this brittle feature that this radio does.
The radios can be designed to have to work for huge ranges.
Is that
right? If that's a design requirement, yeah, sure.
You have to use feedback, the same way it allows you.
Okay, so I didn't know that, but I mean the technology. Let's look at histograms where this is the range of allowable values for a parameter, and this is a histogram of how often that showed up in a set that works. For most parameters, it's just flat. There's no bias toward preferring big or small values. For some parameters, there's a peak, a mild peak. And what we did is we picked a box allowing tenfold variation of parameters in this huger box and centered that smaller box on the peaks of parameters that had peaks in these histograms. And then we found that the hit rate was 4 of 5 in this still quite large box. So here are transects in parameter space. So the idea is we find a point that works and we explore what happens along lines parallel to the coordinate axes as we change one parameter holding the others fixed to find these transects. Yep.
I was wondering what would be the situation where you're sort of thinking the unsaturated regime of certain curves, and then changing, say, the half saturation comes for free. If it works already, then you're not.
That's almost certainly why we get this robustness, that when we have a threshold and you're beyond the threshold, it doesn't matter how much beyond the threshold you are.
That's not quite fair,
It's not quite fair, but these sigmoid curves are, have this consequence that natural selection has exploited, evidently.
That's why it worked.
Yeah, that's why it worked. So the point I want to make here is that if we pick a parameter set like this one. Each one of the columns is a single parameter set. And we move along that axis holding the other parameters fixed. Low values of this function means it works. High values means it doesn't. There's typically a large range within which this network works to do the test problem just as well for all parameter choices along this line. There's a few cases where narrow restriction of a parameter is necessary to make this work, but those are rare. Now, when you move across such a line and you hit one of these jumps where the network stops functioning, it doesn't stop making patterns, it makes a different pattern. And here are some of the different patterns nearby the actual pattern that we found. And we found, if we ran a test that says how robustly can the network make this pattern, we found the same kind of hit rate, like 1 in 200. So, in other words, the parameter space is partitioned into zones in which different patterns are made robustly. Yeah. Well, because in the run, for two reasons, we have run this with rows of 30 or so cells. Now that you bring this up, I should highlight that this is not a Turing mechanism. This pattern maker has no intrinsic wavelength. It can make engrailed wingless boundaries at any period you want, depending on initial conditions. And the other way is our universe is toroidal, so you know the four cells represents infinitely many cells in a big ring. Sure, we can't have other than period 4, but we have done this to check out that you could have period 7 or something in wider ribbons of cells. So another, if we take the parameters we find that work in this 4-cell strip and use those parameters in a big wide strip of any number of cells we want, it still works.
You use a 5-cell strip.
If we use a 5-cell strip and we impose the right initial conditions, we can get a period 5 pattern, but you can in the real embryo too. If you change the upstream genes, you can completely. Well, so but the question we're asking is, can this network make this period 4 repeat? So if we're going to have a period 4 repeat, it'll fit in a torus with 4 cells. So it's fair to use that if that's what we're seeking. And then if we want to know, I don't want to spend too much time on this because we also have boundary conditions where we put a dead cell at each end that doesn't do anything, and that doesn't change the results at all. And we have spread it out in two dimensions more, and then more patterns are possible if you have elaborate initial conditions, but still the stripe pattern is possible. So, Lewis, I need some help here because the questions are sinking me here. So what shall I do?
Well, I think people should try and resist. But it is the question. Take one or two.
John.
Probably have this one comment. So you've been discussing exclusively structural stability. Are you going to discuss tests of dynamical stability and return it away from that correct initial state?
Well, I wasn't going to, but since you ask, I will. We have explored what happens when you have fuzzy, noisy initial conditions, and then the hit rate that we get falls slightly, but this robustness still persists big time. So we haven't waited till it got to the attractor and then moved something. We've started with fuzzy initial conditions, including off for all the other genes, and that's a worse perturbation than perturbing it away from the equilibrium it reached.
Yeah, among the cases that work, are there correlations between the allowed 48?
Not that we can find. We look for cross correlations, but we couldn't find any strong cross correlations whatever. If I get to it, I'll have something to say about different regions in parameter space where this works. So I want to point out briefly that if the black curve represents parameter sets along one particular axis that work, what we're finding is these broad flat valleys in the function where low values say the network works and high values say it doesn't. Broad low valleys with no sharp optimum in the middle. And right up next to them are broad flat valleys where another pattern forms robustly. And we think this is a great situation for natural selection because microevolutionary changes can spread a population polymorphically across these valleys with no phenotypic consequence until the next tiny microevolutionary change pops you into the domain in which you now robustly make a different pattern, which could be advantageous in some different environment. So this consequence of having the phenotype, the pattern the network makes, being almost unchangeable as you change here, has the consequence because the volume of parameter space is fixed, has the consequence of separating these zones where one pattern is made from zones in which the other pattern is made by very sharp cliffs that are easy to cross with tiny perturbations. So I'll skip that. And I just want to say that the robustness here that we stumbled on, we found simply astonishing, this 1 in 200 hit rate. It's astonishing until we start to think about it and realize that if networks weren't robust in this way, then in polymorphic populations, functional networks wouldn't be heritable, because the networks in you are built from these parts that have never worked together before. And the polymorphisms that Rockman and Ray documented are of large magnitude. And if the network's function wasn't independent of the strengths of its connections, almost everybody would be dead. Now, this leads us now to expect that all real evolved networks are going to turn out to be robust. And this is a philosophical remark. The anticipated robustness makes it very tempting to think of genetic networks as powerful and valid units of natural selection. The pieces of DNA that make a genetic network are far flung on the genome. They're not tightly linked. But the robustness of the interactions between the pieces, I think, compensates for the weak linkage between them. So to say this simply, it seems to me that the selfish network is what you ought to think about to try to comprehend evolution, and that selfish networks will prevail over selfish genes, and in these selfish networks, individual genes compete to be optimal cooperators rather than opponents. So this is my vision of how parameter space looks, although we have only incomplete evidence for that. If this is a three-dimensional slice of parameter space, there are, we find, for another network, certain blobs in parameter space, clouds, within which almost every point leads to successful function of the network, but outside of which the network doesn't work. And these clouds are far apart, so that within this cloud you can breed individuals and get functioning networks. Within this cloud you can, but you can't crossbreed between them. And we think this has some clinical relevance. The idea is if you're a lucky person whose network is here, it will take many and big somatic mutations to kick you out of the domain of normal function. Whereas if you're here, your network may work fine until some tiny somatic perturbation kicks you out to here, at which point this network fails. Most of these genes in this network are oncogenes, by the way.
No, because he wants to go. I can ask later.
Are
you sure? Yeah, but
there are
many questions.
I don't know. Okay, so because, see, I want to talk about at least one, some new things that we did. These are the people who did this. George von Dassau.
You still got half an hour, isn't it?
What?
You still got half an hour.
I do?
Yeah.
Does anybody have a question?
I
thought I was.
Another 10 minutes. Come on. I'm getting
Yes. No questions.
No.
Okay. So I want to point out that I didn't do this. I didn't do this. George von Dassau started this off by starting a too ambitious project in a course I taught. And this project got an A and grew like the Sorcerer's Apprentice into his PhD thesis and entrained Ellie Meyer and Ed Monroe and me. So Ellie is the prime mover for the neurogenic network model that I'll talk about now. And he is the software architect who gave the overall form to our software, which is downloadable from from the web. He's an expert computer programmer. I will argue with you later. It's the most beautiful computer language ever made, and the speed hit is no longer important. When we started, the speed hit was serious. It's no longer important. And besides, computers are cheap, and we run this in parallel on dozens of... And Edmund Rowe is in this project was the equation basher and inventor of numerical algorithms, although George invented some. And these three guys together did this project. I wrote some of the software. We want to really express appreciation to Dalil Nasser, who recently died at NSF, for funding this project when it looked like a pretty flaky thing to do. So this is the neurogenic network that Ellie made a model of, and I'm not going to have time to talk about the details, but this is the famous lateral inhibition network whereby delta and notch cause one cell that gets a head start in some fashion to inhibit all the cells around it from adopting neural fate, for example. And in the model that we studied, we wanted to study this Akeet-Skute subnetwork coupled to the delta notch network in the way that you see indicated. I don't have time to go through all this, but this is a curious network in which this is an autocatalytic switch in which the products of either a Akeet or a Skute, when they complex with daughterless, make a factor that feeds back to promote their own synthesis. So this is an autocatalytic switch, a dual switch, so that if you turn either of these genes on, they both pop on. And this is coupled to a negative feedback in this way, which is kind of a thermostat, you know, for your home heating, such that when these levels rise, it shuts off the genes that make the products that keep those genes on. So this is almost an oxymoron, but we look at this as analogous to an electrical engineering principle that says use an operational amplifier of very high gain only with strong negative feedback to make it insensitive to noise. So does that make sense? Okay. So what we did is the same kind of modeling, and we asked, by the way, this notch delta complex does not, of course, turn on suppressor of hairless, but that's functionally roughly what happens. The complexing of notch with delta leads to a process that turns that off. Okay, so Ellie, and then we asked, there's a different test. Can a single cell surrounded by six, having a head start with the proneural genes, suppress the others and be the sole winner? Can a line of cells with a head start suppress the others and become the winner and make a line in a two-dimensional grid of cells? Or can a single cell next to another, surrounded by dead cells, dominate a single cell? So these are three tests that we imposed.
In sort of biological terms, how much head start do you have to give to get the thing happening?
So we didn't want a winner simply because we gave so much of a head start that it was already the winner.
Yeah.
So these tests were passed only if you could get, if you could start, I think, with 10% more at this level.
Yeah.
And also you got the same result if you start with 10% more at a higher level. So we tried to make the winning of the contest not depend just on the actual level, but a small initial difference at both a high and a medium level of expression. Okay. So we could make the same kind of wheel plots, and we get roughly the same hit rates, and so we find this network to be roughly as robust as the segment polarity network. We decided, Ellie and I did, that our measure of robustness was really naive biologically. I mean, nothing goes around sampling parameters in some enormous volume. So we invented a new computational measure of robustness, which goes like this. This is a 2D slice of parameter space. Suppose we find, by accident, a parameter set that works right here. What we do is we do something like simulated population dynamics, where we take that parameter set and we use it as the founder of a population of networks, each of which has a slightly different mutated parameter set. So we expand this point out into a cloud, and then we mate, in quotes, this generation of parents with each other to produce offspring networks by simulating crossovers where we think of each parameter as an allele, that so that the offspring randomly gets its value of some parameter either from one parent or the other. And we then keep expanding this cloud by mutations that we simulate until we get fewer than 90% success rate in making offspring networks by randomly mating the current members of the cloud. And we amplify each parameter we find into a little blob within which almost always mating produces good offspring. And then what we find is countless little blobs where typically the ratio, the average ratio of biggest value to smallest is between 3 and 10, so not factors of 1,000. We find a central zone in parameter space where these blobs within which matings produce viable offspring, that these blobs are bigger, and moreover, they densely overlap. So there's this box in the middle, not in the middle, but in a part of parameter space where 4 out of 5 random hits will work, and 90% work within these clouds that overlap. And that's, so the vision we have is the parameter space is just pockmarked with little, not so little, factor of 10 variation clouds within which the network works dependably no matter where you are. But with that, but you cannot mate parameter sets here and here and get a high success, high viability in the offspring. And we think that's a much better measure of robustness, but we can't imagine ever really mapping the whole parameter space because a 50-dimensional space is really big. And No. This is a caricature of the whole. As a matter of fact, it's a 68-dimensional parameter space for this model, and this is just a 2-dimensional picture. But we're expanding it in every possible direction in the high-dimensional parameter space.
What exactly? Said that you are mating parameters.
Yes.
What is exactly?
Okay, so it's a fake mating, but we think of these 69 parameters, let's say, as loci along a genome, and we have these two sets of parameters, and we constitute a new set by randomly picking the value of the parameter from one or the other parent, which is a way to simulate promiscuous crossovers in a population that was haploid and had recombination in its mating with promiscuous crossovers. We should be doing this with a diploid set of parameters, but that's too much computer time. Yeah.
So can you have a robust network with such a large parameter volume? It's attempting to say they can actually simplify. So to what extent
simplify,
for example, to maybe Boolean analogy. So to what extent you need Boolean analogy to capture this thing?
We don't know, although our slope at the halfway point can be very high and our networks can be nearly Boolean, and those work best of all. But if you had to say one thing that confers robustness, one crude measure of how you boost robustness, it's boost all the slopes of the sigmoid curves. If we impose the constraint that none of these curves be cooperative, so they all look like Michaelis-Menten curves, then we never find any parameter sets that work at all. If we allow some of them to be at least quadratic, then we start finding parameter sets. If we push them all up to be at least 4, so that it's like a fourth order polynomial, then we get slightly higher robustness. But you get almost all of the good that high slopes are going to do when you get to cooperativity of about 3.
No more questions. Sorry, you have to ask me. Sorry.
Okay, this is somewhat important. We had those 3 tests for that neurogenic network, and the interesting finding is that the domain, this is again a 2-dimensional slice of parameter space, the domain in which one of the tests is passed overlaps the domains in which the other tests are passed, which means if some primordial thing made the network pass this test, it could wander through mutations all over here and discover the territory in which this central cell in a hexagon surround would work, and still this older function would work, and within that overlap it could wander and find a setting of the parameters in which the straight line boundary test would be passed. Okay, I'm just gonna try to say this very fast because the clock says I have 1 minute. So this was a ridiculous assumption. In fact, there's a lot of helper genes, or important, important genes left out. And in particular, this signal transduction pathway is vastly oversimplified here. So with some trepidation, we put in a model for it. And now, instead of wingless in this cell turning on and grailed over here directly by an arrow, it instead complexes with frizzled. That complex disheveled is involved in a way that we didn't explicitly represent. That complex leads here to a reduction in the degradation of armadillo, of beta-catenin, so that it can't complex with pangolin and move into the nucleus to turn on and grailed. We haven't yet put together a model that uses the Gary Struhl version, or revision of this. But anyway, when we put this version in, we boosted the parameter count to something like 80, and I was betting that by putting in this chain of steps, any one of which, if broken, would make the whole network fail, we were not going to find any parameter sets that worked. But instead, we got the opposite result. This is a graph of complexity measured by parameter count. This is the network I've mostly been talking about with its hit rate of 1 in 200, and this is the log of the inverse hit rate. So high values mean not robust, and low values mean more robust. And what actually happened is that the hit rate went from 1 in 200 to 1 in 100 when we added these extra steps and their other 30 parameters needed to represent them. So when we add real biological complexity, the hit rate goes up. When we cut RNAs out, here, then the hit rate goes way down. Take note, mathematicians, by doing the obvious simplification that anybody in their right mind would do. I mean, why squander the time to represent RNAs that are just a stepping stone to proteins? Well, it makes a difference in the robustness of the network. Let's see. So I want to concentrate on this remark. Oh, I better say them all. When we cut any connection in the core network, it doesn't work at all. So it's not redundancy that leads to this robustness. When we add random links to the networks, then the hit rate almost always collapses, almost always decreases. So it's not haphazard complexity that generates this robustness. Somehow evolution has crafted over deep time a network whose pattern formation repertoire is somehow encoded in the topology of its connections in a way that's just immune to changes in the strengths and functional forms of those connections.
What is the definition of core?
It's just the simple network, the network in which wingless turns on and grailed directly. That was our core, you know, in vitro reconstitution thing. Okay. We don't have time for that. I'm finished. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'm sorry to run over. And thank you, Lewis, thank you for inviting me to this meeting. You guys have made a really interesting meeting.
Well, listen, hold on a second.